So that's and it, you know, that was so offensive, that was so aggressive, and I don't understand why people didn't challenge him more directly. And now he's just saying whatever he wants without facing real criticize and deep criticize. And I think that that will be difficult, because he's more provocative than Marine Le Pen, who is the head of the current far right, the National Rally.
We want to thank you so much, Rukaya, for joining us. Rukaya Diallo, French journalist, writer, and filmmaker, contributing writer for The Washington Post. We'll link to her piece, Josephine Baker Enters the Pantheon. Don't let it distract from this larger story. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
And you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon faith leaders speak out in favor of preserving the right to have an abortion. President Biden announces his new battle plan against a new variant of COVID-19 as he warns case counts are about to climb again this winter. And Oregon approves its first ever climate change and carbon plan for its 29 million acres of forests. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 2nd, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregonians gathered for what they called bans off our bodies as the U.S. Supreme Court hears the pivotal case that could overturn Roe v.ersus Wade. They included State Senator Deb Patterson from the Salem area, who's also known as Reverend Dr. Deb Patterson, an ordained clergy member of United Church of Christ.
I have seen religion used as a way to keep women and people of color in their place. For people of color, that has contributed to the systemic racism and oppression that has included slavery, Jim Crow laws, redlining, the appropriation of land, and much more for millennia. For women, religion has been used to deny equal access to professions, including the clergy, where there are still barriers for women today in many faith traditions. Religion in our country and elsewhere has been used to deny women equal access to education, to legal protections, to ownership of property, and in the case of reproductive rights, even to ownership of their own bodies when pregnancy has occurred. I believe in the separation of church and state. In both my separate roles as a clergy person and as an elected official, I am convinced that the 51% of the population which bears the physical responsibility for pregnancies should not bear the undue burden of being forced to carry a pregnancy to term unless that is the choice of the person who is going to bear. We need to reduce child poverty, make housing and healthcare more affordable, put childcare costs on a sliding scale, or even better, make it free, and have maternity and paternity leave that actively supports families. Just like the COVID-19 vaccine does not prevent every breakthrough infection, contraception available today does not prevent every pregnancy. Some who find themselves unexpectedly pregnant are willing and able to give birth to and raise a child, a relationship that usually lasts until the end of the parent's days. As an adoptive parent of two adult children, I am overjoyed at their presence in our lives. And if that is an option for someone facing an unplanned pregnancy who cannot raise a child, I know there are people out there who are longing to be parents. That's why our Senate Health Committee is sponsoring a bill asking the legislature to consider requiring coverage for in vitro fertilization. But someone who finds themselves unexpectedly pregnant and who does not want to continue that pregnancy must have the option to make medical choices to end that pregnancy as early as possible and as safely as possible. The U.S. Supreme Court, as you know, is hearing arguments to persuade the members of the court to take away this option. This would be a huge step backwards for human rights. As a person of faith, a faith leader, and as an elected official, I stand for the right of all people of childbearing age to have ownership of their bodies and access to comprehensive medical services.
I'm the Reverend Bill Sinkford, and I serve the First Unitarian Church here in Portland, Oregon. My faith, Unitarian Universalism, has supported a woman's right to choose and her right to control her own body for many decades, long before Roe versus Wade. Our faith is grounded in a set of principles rather than a creed. And the first of those principles is affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of each and every person, the belief that we are all children of God. And that affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person is a hollow promise if half of we the people are denied the right to control our very bodies.
One of my friends chose to end her pregnancy. She wanted to begin her grieving. She wanted to end the suffering of the child and to make sure there was no potential suffering. And so she had an abortion. My other friend chose to carry the fetus to full term so that she could hold her baby while she died. Both grieved. And both women celebrated the medical professionals who supported them in these loving, holy decisions.
Those were some of the faith leaders who came together in Portland to show support for reproductive rights as the U.S. Supreme Court considers a challenge to Roe versus Wade. Forests cover almost 29 million acres in Oregon, almost half the state. The Oregon Department of Forestry has approved its first ever climate change and carbon plan. As Lily Bulkey reports, experts say that signals a commitment to climate smart forest management practices.
The Board of Forestry unanimously approved the plan last month, and the department's forest carbon and forest health policy analyst Danny Norlander says the plan has three legs: adaptation, mitigation, and a social dimension focusing on communities and local economies. He says adaptation is looking at how forests can adapt to the changing environment, using different tree species, for instance, and mitigation is using forests to store carbon.
The third leg there is the social dimensions. We really need to support natural resource dependent economies in rural Oregon that have been experiencing a lot of the impacts from wildfires, the heat wave that we had last summer.
He says the plan also gets into urban and community forestry to make sure no communities get left behind. Grace Braylor with Beyond Toxics says the plan incorporates strategies and goals of a bill passed this year, SCR 17, which calls attention to the disproportionate impact of climate change on BIPOC, immigrant, rural, and low-income communities. She says it also emphasizes the need to invest in a regenerative economy and to have a fair and participatory process.
Incorporating SCR 17's principles into forest practices will result in cleaner air and water, good jobs with family-sustaining wages, and a range of workforce services and skills training, and more climate-resilient forests and communities across Oregon.
Peter Hayes runs an experimental family forest business in the Oregon Coast Range, working towards a better model of forestry. He knows almost half of Oregon is covered in forests, and historically, a lot of focus for forests has been on producing lumber.
Our superpower is the capacity of our land, in particular our forests, to catch and hold carbon. And I think the plan marks a shift toward acknowledging that we need to have a range of priorities.
This is Lily Bulkey with Oregon News Service.
The company behind the Jordan Cove LNG project announced this week that plans to move forward with the natural gas pipeline and export facility have been dropped. Canada-based Pembina, an oil and gas pipeline company, asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, to vacate all previous authorizations, stating in the Wednesday filing they are quitting the project. Spokespeople cite the inability for applicants to obtain necessary state-issued permits and authorizations from various Oregon agencies as reasons to terminate the project. The controversial Jordan Cove pipeline project aimed to bury 229 miles of 26-inch diameter pipe, stretching from a connection point with two additional pipelines in Klamath County to an LNG terminal facility that was proposed to be built on just over 240 acres of property in the port of Coos Bay. Once established, LNG ships would transport cargo from the terminal traveling the Pacific to reach Asian markets. If completed, the pipeline route would have stretched through Coos, Douglas, Jackson, and Klamath counties, crossing major waterways, 87 miles of private land, 60 miles of timberland, and just over 80 miles of public lands. From the onset, the project encountered resistance, with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality denying a water quality certification for the project in 2019. By early 2020, Jordan Cove withdrew its application for a state removal fill permit after being denied an extension on the deadline. As of late July, the State Land Use Board of Appeals reversed an earlier approval for dredging around the proposed terminal location in Coos Bay. Though FERC eventually granted an approval of the project in March, Pembina had still not received the state permits, leading FERC to rebuff a request by the company to bypass DEQ clean water certifications. Opponents to the Jordan Cove pipeline project celebrated Wednesday's withdrawal filings as a victory for local communities. Hannah Soule of Rogue Climate, an organizing group of residents from South Oregon counties, summed up the sentiment, saying, "The defeat of this project shows what communities can accomplish when we insist that public officials put public interest ahead of special interests of big corporations." Opposition is growing to the possibility of toll roads in Oregon. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The Oregon Department of Transportation may add tolls to some of the region's major highways, and many residents aren't pleased with the plan. Clackamas County is voicing its opposition to ODOT plans to add tolls to I-5 and I-205. Both residents and commissioners expressed strong opinions at a virtual town hall meeting held December 1st. Oregon faces a $510 million shortfall every year for monies needed to maintain and repair state roads. One estimate states Portland households will spend 69 hours per year in traffic by 2040. ODOT wants to make the highways more resilient in the face of earthquakes and to take steps to reduce gridlock. The specific projects funded by the tolls would include improving 9 bridges, adding 3 new sound walls, placing 7 new traveler information signs, building a new travel lane in each direction, and adding walking and biking improvements. Residents are saying the tolls are not equitable. A speaker at the Clackamas County virtual town hall meeting called a toll a punitive and regressive tax. The Clackamas Board of Commissioners said that this will have a, quote, disproportionate and detrimental effect on Clackamas County residents, businesses, and visitors, end quote. West Lynn, an Oregon City resident, will likely pay more because of daily commutes to school and work. Some tolls will depreciate property values, and some worry about effects on low-income individuals. Entry-level and unskilled jobs are often not well served by public transit alternatives to driving on a toll road. ODOT previously created a committee to study the impact I-5 and I-205 tolling projects could have on underserved and underrepresented Oregonians. The committee was created as a way of acknowledging past land use and transportation projects in the Portland metro area had negative cultural and economic relational impact on nearby communities, particularly those of low income, communities of color, the elderly and children, and people with limited English proficiency. Citizens are also upset that ODOT can impose tolls without voter approval. The exact amount of the tolls has not been disclosed. There likely will be an extra surcharge at peak times, and there will be no periods at all without any toll charges. Tolling is set to begin in winter of 2024. Residents won't know how much the tolls will be until 6 months in advance, or midway through 2023. At least one petition to prevent tolling is circulating. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
People in a Washington State community were devastated when Everett Community College announced it would close its early education program. It provides free preschool to eligible families. Now, as Emily Scott reports, the college is walking back on that decision and pausing the closure, at least for now.
After community pushback, Everett Community College has paused plans to close its Early Learning Center, which has provided childcare services and nutritional counseling to many low-income families north of Seattle for 29 years. Parents and employees were notified last week through a letter from the college saying that a review of revenue and expenses shows the program is not financially sustainable. Prior to a Tuesday night Board of Trustees meeting, the college sent a letter to the community saying the board will work with state and local leaders to find permanent funding. Michelle Doron, whose three-year-old daughter attends the center, says the program has been a lifeline over the past few months as she's experienced homelessness.
I can't tell you how phenomenal that program has been. The support that I've gotten from the Early Learning Center basically has made it so I don't hit rock bottom. I've been able to maintain a full-time job and get quality childcare.
Everett officials say the center has accumulated a net loss of $700,000 over a five-year period. In its original letter to staff, the college said it planned to close the center next June 30th and that 14 employees would be laid off. Everett Community College said it's interested in turning the lease of the building over to the YMCA of Snohomish County to run a daycare program. Amy Waters of the Early Learning Center says she's encouraged that there's a chance to fight for the future of the program because she doesn't think the YMCA would be able to provide the same high-quality education.
The YMCA starts their lead teachers at $13 an hour and they cap out a little over $17. So their ending wage is lower than our starting wage. To have the Young Men's Christian Association take over our beautiful, diverse program feels very insulting.
The Early Learning Center was accredited by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. Less than 10% of childcare and early education centers in the U.S. receive this accreditation. I'm Emily Scott with Washington News Service.
You are listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, and at 8, Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather will be chilly, down to 34 under mostly cloudy skies. Tomorrow, it gets up to 46. It'll be mostly cloudy with occasional showers late at night. We could dip down below the freezing mark Saturday night into Sunday with a low of 29. Highs in the 40s Saturday and Sunday. Today in history, on this date in 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency opened as a new federal agency created in response to the realization that human activity can have major effects on our planet. The quote of the day is from Mahatma Gandhi, "Earth provides enough to satisfy every man's needs, but not every man's greed." Labor groups are becoming more active after a period of relative quiet during the pandemic. Suzanne Potter reports on why strikes and protests are increasing.
Labor protests and strikes are on the upswing this fall compared with 2020, when everyone hunkered down as the pandemic closed whole sectors of the economy. According to the Cornell University Strike Tracker, California has seen 60 labor strikes from January to the end of November, and there were 334 nationwide. Sarah Cabezas-Prendergast with the Mount Diablo School Psychologists Association says her union just voted to authorize an unfair labor practices strike because the district has rejected a contract that it agreed to almost 2 years ago.
It's been a long time without a contract, and our members are really irritated, and they're ready to unite and organize and really fight for our fair contract.
A date for the strike has not yet been set. Mount Diablo Unified School District did not respond to a request for comment by deadline, but officials there have said they can't afford to honor the pre-pandemic contract. There have been 4 strikes and 13 labor protests at schools and universities across the state so far this year. They include actions by teachers in Pleasanton and lecturers at the University of California. Cabezas-Prendergast says employers need to keep up with prevailing wages so workers can afford to stay.
It's a matter of time before people start to get mad enough to decide to organize and do something about it. And I think we're going to continue to see this.
Right now, workers have more leverage because the unemployment rates are lower than they've been in decades. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, unemployment nationwide in October stood at 4.6%, down from 14% in April 2020. In California, those unemployment numbers stand at 7.3%, down from a high of 16% during the lockdowns. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The U.S. Supreme Court will continue debating the future of abortion rights. Stacey Abrams will again run to be Georgia's governor. And Congress scrambles to avoid a shutdown. Here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
We're running on 50 years of Roe. It is an egregiously wrong decision.
Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart urged the U.S. Supreme Court to uphold the state's law banning abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy before viability. The case challenges the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that made abortions a constitutional right. Stewart argued Roe takes away the state's ability to protect a life, which Justice Sonia Sotomayor said was a religious view.
When does the life of a woman and putting her at risk enter the calculus?
Meanwhile, Justice Samuel Alito and other conservatives appear to lean toward limiting abortion rights.
Can a decision be overruled simply because it was erroneously wrong?
Thousands rallied outside the court during arguments. Here's New Mexico Democratic Congresswoman Teresa Ledger Fernandez.
A woman, wherever she lives, whoever she is, she deserves the right to make her own decisions.
Republican Congresswoman Mary Miller of Illinois gathered with pro-life activists.
We're praying that this would be overturned.
Nearly half of states are expected to ban abortions should Roe be thrown out. In election news, voting rights activist Stacey Abrams is running for Georgia governor in 2022. Republican Brian Kemp narrowly defeated Abrams in 2018, but Democrats believe recent demographic and political changes in the state could hand a victory to Abrams. Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker won't seek re-election next year. The moderate Republican was seen as the GOP's best chance of keeping the office in the heavily Democratic state. And after 3 decades in Congress, Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio won't seek re-election. DeFazio heads the House Transportation Committee. Congress has just 2 days remaining to avoid a government shutdown. However, Republicans are trying to block a short-term funding deal unless they get a vote on an amendment to stop the Biden administration from implementing its vaccine mandate for large employers.
Why would anybody in this chamber vote to fund a government that is going to mandate that people have to lose their jobs through these unlawful orders?
That's Texas Republican Chip Roy. Meanwhile, Democrats are urging the Senate parliamentarian to allow immigration protections to be allowed in the social spending bill. Reconciliation bills, which can pass a filibuster-proof majority, must primarily impact the federal budget. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi hosted a 6-decades-old tradition, the annual lighting of the Capitol Christmas tree.
As a proud Californian, it is especially exciting that this 84-foot tree, white fir, hails from California's Six Rivers National Forest.
And on Pennsylvania Avenue, Vice President Kamala Harris reflected on the lessons of Hanukkah at the White House menorah lighting.
The power of the people, the possibility of the future, that even in despair, there is hope. That even in darkness, there is light.
It's the first Hanukkah celebrated at the White House with the Jewish spouse of a president or vice president, Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network in Public News Service.
President Joe Biden announced a new strategy today aimed at tackling potential winter surges of COVID-19 as the new Omicron variant had its first confirmed U.S. case on Wednesday. There have been two more since then. Biden is using what's being called a multi-pronged approach to facing upcoming coronavirus challenges, with heavy emphasis on expanding vaccinations to Americans who haven't gotten the shots yet and providing boosters to all now eligible adults. He'll also impose modifications on international travel, requiring tests closer to arrival dates in the U.S., and pressing insurance companies to pay for at-home test kits. The president says he is stopping short of mandating shutdowns on schools and businesses in efforts to maintain the country's economic recovery. He noted likely spikes in cases over the coming weeks and acknowledged as the weather turns colder and people will be congregating indoors, and further steps to require vaccinations for large employers will be stalled due to current requirements tied up in court decisions. Biden's speech today also grimly noted how the politicization of anti-COVID measures such as mask wearing and vaccinations has caused a bitter divisiveness among the nation's people. But he says his new plan will pull no punches in the fight against COVID. Here's part of what he had to say.
This new variant is cause for concern, but not panic. We knew there'd be cases of Omicron here in the United States, and it's here. But we have the best tools, the best vaccines in the world, and the best medicine, and the best scientists in the world. We're going to fight this variant with science and speed, not chaos and confusion. Just like we beat back COVID-19 in the spring and more powerful variant, Delta variant, in the summer and fall. As a result, we enter this winter from a position of strength compared to where America was last winter. Last Christmas, fewer than 1% of American adults were fully vaccinated. This Christmas, that number will be 72%, including more than 86% of seniors, the most vulnerable population. Last Christmas, our children were at risk without a COVID-19 vaccine. This Christmas, we have safe, effective vaccines for children age 5 and older, with 20 million children and counting now vaccinated. Last year, a majority of our schools were closed Christmas time in that area. Now, over 99% of our schools are open. But I pledge to always be straight and give it just straight from the shoulder as President of the United States and tell the American people exactly where we are. So here it is. Experts say the COVID-19 cases will continue to rise in the weeks ahead in this winter. So we need to be ready. You can read the whole plan we're talking about here at whitehouse.gov. Go to whitehouse.gov and it's all laid out in detail. For now, here are the 5 key points I want to expand on slightly. We're expanding our national booster campaign to provide booster shots to all eligible adults. Our docs and the scientists believe that people who get a booster shot are more protected than ever from COVID-19. I was just told, which is a question I got to ask, I've been meaning to ask for a long time, whether or not just it increases the resistance to the variant that is being dealt with, but it is stronger. It not only just raises the total, but it's a stronger, makes things more powerful in terms of resisting. And the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and our top public officials recommend all adults get a booster shot when it's time. But here's the deal. More than about 100 million are eligible for boosters.
Juneau's Education Board in Alaska approves Tlingit oral narrative standards, and the Navajo Nation's police chief will step down at the end of December. With these stories more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Juneau, Alaska's Board of Education has approved new oral narrative standards for its Tlingit culture, language, and literacy program. These are the first oral narrative standards to be developed for the language to be taught to school children. The program is available to K through 5th in the Juneau School District. It requires an application and acceptance through a lottery. Before the school board's vote in mid-December, the district's Director of Teaching and Learning Support, Ted Wilson, expressed it was an important step in a long journey.
We also have representatives from the preschool and from UAS so that we can talk about what curriculum looks like all the way through from when you're tiny until you are in college.
Wilson says they'd like to see the program expand to other grade levels. The final reading of the standards during the school board meeting prompted several emotional responses from the public and new board member Amber from hers.
I'm Danae from Arizona, and this is a gift that you are presenting to probably many of families who are not able to share it as much as we want to. I would love to teach my own children our language, but I was not taught my language.
Paul Marks also spoke at the meeting about the standards.
I just want to say thank you to all those that are working towards a standard of our people to be taught to our children. Our elders were the ones who taught us, and they taught us so that we would teach our children.
The school district is working with Alaska Native Community Partners and is developing a reading and writing curriculum for the program. The Navajo Nation's chief of police has announced he'll step down from his post at the end of the month. Philip Francisco ushered in key reforms credited with growing the ranks of the chronically understaffed department. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
Francisco was chosen to lead the Navajo Police Department in 2016 after the job had been vacant for several years. During his tenure, the tribe's police academy was reestablished, which helped boost recruitment on the force tasked with policing large sections of the mostly rural reservation. Currently, about 200 tribal officers patrol the area larger than West Virginia. A recent study recommended the Navajo Nation needs about triple that amount of officers. Francisco also led the push to increase officer salaries, which Navajo leaders leaders say helps with recruitment and retention. He's taken a job as the new chief of the much smaller Bloomfield Police Department in northwestern New Mexico, which is his hometown. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez praised Francisco, saying the tribe's police department has been vastly improved under his leadership. Navajo Deputy Police Chief Daryl Noon will take over the top job on the force when Francisco steps down at the end of the year. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Lac-Couturier Tribal Governing Board and the Wisconsin-Sawyer County Sheriff's Office were unable to reach an agreement on a tribal county law enforcement grant, which had a deadline of November. The grant for 2022 supported a part-time sheriff's deputy to help law enforcement on the reservation. At issue was jurisdiction between tribal or county court. Since the agreement was not signed, the county forfeited nearly $50,000 from the state for the deputy, funded by gaming compacts. According to the tribal newspaper, all parties have agreed to begin work on an agreement for 2023. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Suzanne Potter, Lily Volke, and Emily Scott. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Native Voice One and Public News Service. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Full Omath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
This week on Making Contact. For the past couple decades, an increasing amount of gas and oil has been fracked in an area that stretches from